Welcome to episode 315 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Miranda Barnwell,
Michael O'Malley.
In today's episode, we will be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we'll be kicking off our new Films of Agnes Varda series with her first feature, 1955's La Pointe Court. So, an exciting series. If you did not catch our lineup, go over to cinematary.com. It's there. But let's go ahead and jump into movies that we saw this week. I will kick us off with two movies that I caught recently. The first one is a new release, and that comes from Joost and Schulman, the directing duo behind Nerve, which, if you have not seen Nerve, high recommend. I think it's on Hulu. It's out there somewhere. Go check out Nerve. It's a great movie. This one is it's called Project Power. It stars Jamie Foxx, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Courtney B. Vance, Machine Gun Kelly. It plays a drug dealer. So it's got all the stuff. It's got everything that you're looking for in a movie. But pretty much the premise is it takes place in New Orleans, and this kind of shadow corporation thing has come into New Orleans with this special pill where whenever you take the pill, it like activates all this stuff and the person gets a superpower. And sometimes it's just kind of like a, you know, like you're shaking up a bottle and then it just burst out. You just kind of get a random superpower. It's not like you take a special pill and you can fly. You know, it's just kind of, you don't know what you're going to get. And so as you get kind of deeper into the movie, you learn that the pill is, you know, naturally the police are trying to get the pill off the streets because I guess, you know, sometimes, you know, the superpower is, oh, I'm just going to, you know, my body becomes a bomb or I light on fire or something like that. And so people are dying from this pill. But we have three kind of main characters that's following. The first is this teenage girl who is selling the superpower pills on the street. Then you have a cop played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is like kind of the New Orleans equivalent of like the Boston cop, who's like, you know, he stayed in his hometown and he's just trying to make the community right. There's like Joseph Gordon-Levitt has like this strong the government came in after Katrina and you saw what happened. Like it has like this whole undercurrent where it's just like New Orleans being gentrified, which I was like, that's a cool angle. I don't know how I feel about the, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt cop character kind of being the you know, voice for that, but whatever. And then you have this ex-soldier played by Jamie Foxx who was kind of in on the ground floor of this superpower pill, but you know, things went awry and they kidnapped his daughter to test out the various effects from these pills. And so it kind of has that Nerve vibe to it. For those who didn't see Nerve, you have this whole conceit where there's a app where you pick truth or dare, and if you pick dare, they start you know, having these various levels of elevated just stuff that you're supposed to do. You know, sometimes it can be like jump, you know, between buildings or run in front of cars, things of that nature. And so it kind of has like that high concept to it where, you know, you have these pills with all these superpowers, and like Jimmy Fox's character shows up and is trying to figure out where the stream of pills are coming from. And so he meets up with the Machine Gun Kelly character, and the Machine Gun Kelly character like takes one of the pills and becomes like the Human Torch from Fantastic Four, except, you know, in like real life, it's just fire burning him alive for the most part, but he's still able to like move around and stuff. And it really does like include this kind of interesting special effects work. You know, I don't know, for me, sometimes the special, you know, you can kind of just forget about special or visual effects when you're watching, especially like the most, like the biggest of blockbusters, you know, the Marvels, the DC movies, and even like the Star Wars, those kind of films, almost they have like the whole hidden special effects where it kind of just wants to include it in the film, but not, you know, it still wants to have like this natural approach. And Joost and Schulman, like they kind of implement this. It just kind of, it has almost like this, it's not an insult, but like a like a B movie, like it's like a bargain bin, Walmart bargain bin aesthetic to it, where it just seems totally absurd. But then you also have like this really kind of thought out high concept of you have this superpower pill that's just like taking over the streets of New Orleans that is, you can do cursory Google search research and learn about the effects of gentrification in New Orleans, especially since Katrina hit that region. And so it has like some interesting ideas kind of floating around, and I like the whole pill aspect of it, but it also really doesn't ever kind of complete itself, really. It kind of has like these three characters and gives them very very flimsy, very basic kind of narrative plot, ABC points that they kind of follow, which is fine, but it kind of makes up for it with these really spectacular set piece special effects moments. And when those come up, it's great. It's super fun. This would absolutely have been like a great movie to like watch in a movie theater on the big screen instead of your, Netflix on your home TV. But when those moments happen, it's great. But for the most part, it just kind of muddles around. It really doesn't have like, really isn't coalesced like Nerve did. So Project Power, it's kind of a fun time. It's on Netflix. So if you're looking for, I don't know, kind of just a silly, nice, fun blockbuster movie, since you can't go to the movie theaters, I would check out Project Power. Or just, skip that and watch Nerve. This is a hidden Nerve recommendation. So that's my end on that one. The next movie I wanted to talk about, which is now on the Criterion Channel as part of, I think it's kind of a holdover from Pride Month. They had all of these LGBT films, but this one is from 2018, called Rafiki. I cannot pronounce the director's name, and I'm already going to screw up a bunch of names later, so I'm just going to leave it. But 2018's Rafiki. But this film, it takes place in Kenya, and you have these two young women, Kenna and Ziki. And it kind of has like this Romeo and Juliet vibe to it. Their dads are running against, I'm not really totally sure what like the political office is or what it is, but they're both running for this position. And so like you have this you have this like, lesbian couple that's like the Romeo and Juliet to these like two kind of political families, one with like, relatively large amount of money, and the other kind of more working class. Like Kenna's father owns like a convenience store or something like that. But it starts out, they're kind of friends for a while, even though they have the whole, the dads are, competing against each other, and it's a pretty, cookie cutter kind of romance story. They're friends, they start falling in love, and then they get together, but then it kind of shifts into a relatively cookie cutter LGBT story where instead of it being, it kind of, the whole conceit that kind of hides from the from it being kind of by the books, is that you're enveloped in kind of this political climate in Kenya where it really has this kind of conservative, anti-LGBT stance. You don't really face it head on. You have this kind of cursory character who talks to one of Kenna's friends and also mocks this, outed gay character who lives in town as well, with just this like blatant homophobia. And so that, naturally the people find out about their relationship, and some of that starts to kind of crop up. But it, like I said, it's a relatively basic by the books, queer romance story, You know, but it also is anchored. It has these two really wonderful lead performances. It has this incredible soundtrack. I've been like listening to the soundtrack the last couple days after I watched it, because it has this one pop singer who does the theme song and some song, you know, some of the songs throughout the movie, and she kind of has like this, you know, it's maybe it's hyperbole, but like kind of this Beyonce kind of pulse to and singing style. It's really great. It's some good pop songs. I would recommend at the very least to check out Rafiki, just because it has a really killer soundtrack. But yeah, it's on the Criterion Channel right now. It's a really, I think it's a movie that it's kind of a bummer that it's stuck on. It sounds bad, but it's a bummer that it's stuck on Criterion, because if this was like on Netflix or Hulu or something a little bit more mainstream, I feel like you know, people in the age range of the characters in this movie would really dig this, because it's like it's kind of something that you probably would see as like a Netflix original movie, but I think is except way more, better directed, and has like its own unique vision and feel. The set design and the lighting in this movie is incredible. But Rafiki, check it out. I've talked way too long, so Miranda, I'm going to toss it over to you to talk about your movie.
Yeah, okay, well, that sounds really cool. I'm going to have to check that one out. All right, so I recently rewatched It's a Wonderful Life. My friend and I were talking about it, so we rewatched it. I rewatched it, and I had seen it a few times before it, but it's been a few years. So It's a Wonderful Life was directed by Frank Capra, and I believe that was 1946. Okay. So I'm sure people know the general plot, right? Like, it's George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart. And the movie starts off with this angel. So there are these prayers that are being said for George Bailey, that God is receiving. You know, please save George Bailey, you know, tell him we love him. And God gets these messages from, are these prayers, and sends an angel, Clarence, down to Earth to save, you know, George Bailey and talk to him and, you know, tell him about the greatest gift, which is the gift of life. But before he does that, God has to, you know, give him his whole backstory. And I think that is what I was actually surprised the most of watching this again. Like, 2/3 of the movie is this backstory. And then, like, the whole piece that we talk about is the last like 20-30 minutes, where you're like, it's a great movie, but you're like, all right, are we wrapping things up? So and that's the part that was based on a pamphlet, like a short story. And I like Capra's movies in general, but I think there's something about jumping into this movie, just like from this moment that you go to this backstory of George and his friends and him saving Harry, there's like, and then him working in the drugstore, there's just like the sense of warmth and like, I don't know, like warmth, or just like your feel at home, that I think Capra does a really good job with, like, you know, what he puts in the frame and like all the details, like from the magazines to just like the little pieces in the town. But especially with the camera work too. And I don't know, there's like, and I don't know if it's, I didn't grow up with this movie watching it every Christmas when I was younger. That was something I didn't have. I discovered it when I was in high school watching old movies. But there's something that just seems like with this movie, it seems, I don't know if it's like that partial fantasy element of it, but I get the sense that it seems so different from other Hollywood movies I've seen. And I don't know if it's just like this episode, like not necessarily episodic, but like point of, you know, going from George in the beginning of the movie, George being with his family and talking to his dad, to the dance. Like, there's just like this sense, I don't know how even to describe it, the sense of like comfort, or like, I don't know what the movie does, but it's wonderful and I love it. And I highly recommend it. But it is a shame, like, my friend who's seen it, she's like, I have seen this movie so many times, I can't watch it again. And it's a shame, like, she knows it's like a very good movie, but like, we've seen it so many times. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, I always wonder, like, why it's kind of like one of those, like, why that one? Like, why is that one the one that people are attached so much to.
So do you guys know the history of why? Because there actually is like a history here.
I was teeing you up.
Go,
oh yeah,
go.
I'm ready. You put that tee ball on the tee and I'm ready to swing the bat and miss the ball and hit the tee instead, like I always did. But so It's a Wonderful Life was allowed to go into the public domain out of negligence. And so in like the 70s and 80s, it was just shown on TV constantly because people could, like, television stations could show it for free. And so it was kind of like, it wasn't a forgotten movie, like it was a Best Picture nominee and stuff like that. But like it had a period of like time when people weren't really thinking about it that much. But then like when it went into the public domain and like television stations, like local access and stuff started showing it a bunch, it had like a huge resurgence. And so you like in like When Harry Met Sally, for instance, they're like watching it together on TV. And that's I feel like pretty representative of how like most people have seen this movie is like. At least before, like, whatever current media age we're in, is, like, you catch it on TV because it's free for the television stations to show on TV. At least that's what I've been told is the reason why it's so popular. It's also very good, but...
Michael, I know that you've seen it a bunch of times. I mean, what about...
Yeah.
I mean, do you like it, or are you just stuck seeing it a bunch of times?
Yeah, I mean, it's been one of those things... you know, there's like that term for like a, I can't remember what the term is, but like, you know, you tell a joke enough times and you stop liking it and then you keep telling it and it becomes funny again. And I kind of feel like I've been on that ride with this movie because my parents would make me watch it, make the family watch it like every year. Like it was like a yearly thing. So I've probably seen this movie between 15 and 20 times at least. And I got so tired of it when I was like a teenager and like early college. And I've kind of come back around to it, and I think it's really, really great. To like the what you were talking about, Miranda, the warmth. I think one of the things that like movies at this time like hardly ever do, until like in the 60s and 70s when like the Hollywood New Wave people start doing this, is like it has this really like the sound mixing is really, really rowdy. Like the dialogue is like constantly overlapping and the characters are allowed to just like shout over one another and stuff in a way that like, at least I feel like in like the 1930s, like the early sound pictures and golden age Hollywood, like it's a very much like a one person talks and then the other person has a perfectly crafted response. But like this movie, there's so many scenes that are just like crowded with characters and people are just talking. And a lot of times you can't tell everything that's being said. And I think that gives this movie like a really lived in and warm feeling compared to a lot of, I mean, I love a lot of Hollywood movies from this time, but it has a different feel than a lot of classic Hollywood movies. And I think the way that the audio or the dialogue is mixed is like an important part of that.
I would have never thought about that, but now that you say it, I absolutely agree, like 100%. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So yeah. 20 times in, that's my insight.
I love it. Thank you. I couldn't put a finger on it, but there it is.
Michael, you had a movie you want to talk about?
Yeah, so it's not as popular as It's a Wonderful Life, but it's a pretty popular movie that I'm finally catching up with, which is Jerry Maguire, which is a movie that's written and directed by Cameron Crowe from 1996. Probably people know this, but it stars Tom Cruise and has Cuba Gooding Jr. and Renee Zellweger in it. And it's about Tom Cruise is a sports agent, which is something I don't know very much about, so I'm probably going to say stupid things about this. But I guess the sports agent gets tired of only being in it for the money. He gets tired of, like, the rat race of, you know, just kind of, like, hustling athletes to get the biggest possible paycheck for his agency and stuff. And so he, like, writes this manifesto about, like, how we sports agents should be more ethical and actually care about those athletes that we're representing and stuff. And basically it results in like everybody kind of giving him a pat on the back, but also like the sharks who aren't playing his game get all the clients. And then he's just down to Cuba Gooding Jr., who's a football player for the Arizona Cardinals. And so he's kind of like down on his luck as far as like getting clients goes. And so he's got to get new clients and also like give Cuba Gooding Jr. that like personal touch he'd promised in his manifesto. And also the only he gets fired from his agency as a result of all this, too. And the only person who leaves with him is like a woman from accounting who is Renee Zellweger, who was kind of taken by like the posture of his manifesto. And so she's kind of standing.
And he's Tom Cruise.
Say what?
And he's Tom Cruise.
Yeah, although more on that in a second.
okay.
But anyway, so like, I mean, she kind of becomes the de facto love interest. He has a girlfriend at the beginning of the movie who's like, you know, a cutthroat, like sports agent person too. And they have like weird, intense sex that is like brutally honest, and they say weird things. And apparently the brutal honesty is a great path toward breaking up with somebody, because that's what they do eventually. And then he can sweep Renee Zellweger off her feet, and, you know, she can complete him and all that stuff. Which, side note, like, I knew the famous lines from this movie, but I didn't know that all the famous lines from this movie were in this movie. And so this movie is like over 2 hours long, but I felt like a good solid chunk of it was like stuff that I was like, I didn't realize this was from that movie. Like the, I mean, I knew like Show Me the Money was from this movie, but the, there were so many like pieces that I was like, I had no idea this was, Jerry Maguire. Like, I guess I didn't know You Complete Me was from this movie. I knew You Had Me at Hello, which is like the same scene, was from this movie. Anyway, it was weird. It's weird seeing like these like iconic lines that you've only really heard out of context all of a sudden like all line up in a row in the same movie. But anyway, I enjoyed this movie. It is a weird movie. Like, for a movie that's as popular as it is and as iconic as it is, like, I thought it was very weird. Part of that is because Cameron Crowe just has a kind of weird writing style, I think, in like a weird way of doing his movies. And this is like true of both his good and his bad movies, where you just have like, there's plots in his movies, but a lot of his movies feel like this happened and then this happened and then this happened. And a lot of them are big, loud scenes that don't necessarily connect with one another, except they all kind of fit under the umbrella of the plot, but they don't like go from point A to point B in the traditional way. So you like go from Tom Cruise, like, shouting like "Show me the money, I love black people" to like Cuba Gooding Jr. over the phone, to like some like, you know, random like romantic scene and stuff, and I don't know, it's kind of weird, but that's like just Cameron Crowe. And I'm not exactly sure what makes a good Cameron Crowe movie or a bad Cameron Crowe movie, except that I know that there are some that I like this one, and then there are some I don't like We Bought a Zoo, or I don't know. I've not seen Aloha. I know that didn't do super well, but if Nathan were on this podcast, he'd give his
Yeah, Nathan could help you out there.
But anyway, I mean, he's but Tom Cruise is like the second part of what makes this movie so weird, because like Tom Cruise is just such a particular energy in his movies, and it's always like kind of the same energy like in all of his movies, which is just like white hot intensity. And it's like, it made me uncomfortable. Like, there's something weird and compelling about his performance in this movie, where like every scene he looks like he's like talking down a shooter or something. Like, he's just got this like wide-eyed like kind of you know, I guess it's the Scientology look or whatever, but it's like, even in the scene, like the emotional climax of the movie, when he goes to like profess his love to Renee, he like, if you like cross cut that with like something from like War of the Worlds or you know, a Mission Impossible movie, I don't think that it would like, his performance would be out of place. Like, it is so strange. And it kind of works because it's this guy, his character is this guy who's been like, you know, basically high on life as his professional, as this like basically like a professional harasser, you know, who's as a sports agent whose job is like to call up managers and stuff and just like heckle them into giving his representees money. And like it's like he never gets out of that emotional zone, even though like he's not doing that all the movie. Like, but he always looks like he's like some MBA guy who's just done like three lines of coke and is like ready to get like another $1 million for Cuba Gooding Jr. And it's extremely strange that he's like the kind of eventually like the sensitive romantic, you know, sympathetic character in the movie. Because the way Tom Cruise plays him is just so like, it's like just a notch under being like just completely unhinged. And I don't know, like weirdly that makes the movie good for me. I don't know. I can't really explain it. There's just something that comes together with this movie where like all the pieces are super strange and I don't know that they should work together. And it's not like a completely great movie. It's like way too long, for example. It's like almost 2.5 hours long, which is like, come on. But it's like they all come, it's weird. They just all come together and like work together in this weird, like alchemic way. That is, I don't know. I understand why people like this movie because I liked it. But it's also a movie I never would have predicted to have been like the big, like iconic, one of the big iconic movie of the 90s. So anyway.
Well, Tom Cruise has like this, you know, I say this as like a compliment because it's like what I like about especially his best roles, but he's like has like almost this plastic, especially for like the Mission Impossible movies, like this action figure almost like aesthetic where he's like trying to be a normal person, but he feels like he's like a action figure that's come to life that's trying to pretend to be like a normal
that's like
and like that seems to work in this one where it's like because a sports agent I don't feel like is a real it's like a human being really it's just you, like you described a sports agent very well and so it's like it kind of like the fact that you know like you say it feels weird that he went from being like this person shouting down like you know owners and GMs for teams about you know contracts and stuff to like the sensitive romantic type. It's just like, yeah, it seems weird because it's this, you know, doll that came to life that's trying to pretend to be a real person the entire time. And I love that about him.
That's like 100% it. And that's like basically his manifesto at the beginning of the movie where he's just like, hey guys, what if we actually treated other human beings like they were human beings? Because I have this weird theory that we could be human beings too. Like that's kind of like a good paraphrase of like what he writes like in the opening scene of the movie. In my Letterboxd review, I said he kind of feels like Patrick Bateman trying to have a domestic life after a life of murder. But I think action figure also works. But it's so weird. It works. I get the feeling that like if there was something just a little bit not falling into place with this movie, it would not work at all and it would be a disaster. But it all like fits. And it's pretty fun.
Yeah. I mean, just, like, think of, like, his character in Eyes Wide Shut, where he, like, the reason he's perfect in that is because he just feels like this doll that's trying to pretend to be a real person. Like this is what I'm supposed to say right now, and it just feels forced and weird, and you're like, I'm uncomfortable just the way he's trying to describe something. Like the whole like, pot scene just is like the yeah. It explains it all.
Yeah. Or even like his character in like Magnolia. Like there are moments where he in this movie where you feel like that character from Magnolia, like a less misogynist version of that character from Magnolia has walked in, you know, like off the stage. He's got like the headpiece on and like he's like declaring his love to Renee Zellweger, like if he's still on the stage, like talking to all those people, and he's like the like crazed speaker, and it's yeah, like he's just like grasping for like emotional sincerity and like kind of getting it, but in the most roundabout, bizarre way possible.
No, it's he's interesting. I love watching Tom Cruise. He's just like yeah, I mean, man. Like think of my last example, and then we'll finish it up. My last example is that Twitter video of him going to see Tenet in the movie theaters. Did you guys see that?
Oh my gosh! Like yeah. Big screen, good
like,
time.
Like just pure doll has come to life and is trying to be a real person energy through that entire thing. Like he's just like, this is what people do. They come and you know thumbs up next to the big poster and stuff. I'm just like Tom Cruise, like. You just feel like you're forcing stuff so much.
What is this? What is this?
So Tom Cruise went to see Tenet, and he went with the director of the last few Mission Impossible movies, Christopher McQuarrie. And Christopher McQuarrie, like, filmed Tom Cruise going to the movie, and Tom Cruise is like, you know, back to the movies, and, like, has his, like crazy mask on, and is, like, in the theater, like, thumbs-upping at the screen. It's incredible.
I'll have to watch that later.
It's like 30 seconds long. Yeah. You should okay. Watch it soon. It's really entertaining.
It's just like a robot came to life. It's wonderful. Okay. Cool. All right. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to talk about La Pointe Court after this.
Hello, Cinematary listeners. This is your favorite Filipino podcaster, Jessica Carr. I'm here to let you know about a couple of things that Cinematary offers that you might not know about. First, if you're a fan of what Cinematary is doing, please consider joining us on Patreon. Remember when we weren't clamoring for your dollars? Well, now we're just clamoring for five of your dollars. So please help us and donate to our Patreon, and then you'll get exclusive content from our staff, including our film theory and chill series, where a panel takes a piece of theory each month and deconstructs it before diving into whatever topic is on their mind from the past week. The $5 each month is an investment in the website and the podcast, and it goes solely to paying our writers for the reviews each week, so please consider doing it. It's only $5. If you missed an episode of Cinematary or a piece of writing we've had, you should consider signing up for our free newsletter. Each Sunday, we send out a note with the latest podcast episode, piece of Patreon content, and the last two reviews that we've written at cinematary.com. It's perfect for those of you who are interested in what's happening, and it makes sure that you don't miss a single Cinematary review. Finally, the easiest thing that you can do to help us is to please, please give us a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever else you're using to listen to the show. This helps us get more eyeballs and ears on the podcast and the website, and it helps the people know about Cinematary, which is really what we're here for. So to recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and give us a rating or review. We would really appreciate if you could do these things. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Voilà combien de jours, voilà combien de nuits, voilà combien de temps que tu es reparti. Tu m'as dit cette fois, c'est le dernier voyage pour nos cœurs déchirés, c'est le dernier naufrage. Au printemps, tu verras, je serai de retour. Le printemps, c'est joli pour se parler d'amour. Nous irons voir ensemble les jardins refleuris et déambulerons.
And we are back with part two of episode 315 of Cinematary. In this part, we'll be starting our Agnes Varda series with 1955's La Pointe Court. It's written and directed by Varda and stars Sylvia Monfort and Philippe Noiret. And it's about a young man who is a native of the seaside village of La Pointe Court, France. And he's having a hard time understanding why his bored, Paris-born wife of 4 years is unhappy with their marriage. The couple visit La Pointe Court as they try to resolve their problems. Meanwhile, the locals of the rural community grapple with the hardships and tragedies of their daily lives. A young child dies, a government official hassles fishermen, and a marriage is arranged. At age 25, Varda originally visited La Pointe Court to take pictures for a friend who could no longer visit her home. After seeing the footage she took there, she rented a camera to shoot a film about a couple from Paris who were visiting La Pointe Court, the husband's hometown. The budget of the film was $14,000, roughly one quarter the budget of other feature films of the era, including The 400 Blows and Breathless. No members of the cast or crew were paid during the production. Varda talked a little bit with the site Bright Wall Dark Room about the history of, or like the steps that this movie was made. And so, in the recounting, so the cast, including a then unknown 25-year-old named Philippe Noiret, and crew rented a tiny house and ate meals and lived there together. Once shooting was complete, though, Varda needed to edit it, and so she had heard about Alain René from reading André Bazin, So she wrote a letter to him, and he came to the lab to watch her rushes. And fastidious and precise in manner, Renee viewed two of her 9 hours of the film and said nothing, only telling her later that evening over the phone that he couldn't edit her film because it too closely resembled his own research he was doing into filmmaking. She said she cried then. It was bad portent. He did give her some technical advice and assigned her the laborious and arcane task of preparing the physical film rushes to be edited. And 10 days later, she called him, and when Renee heard she'd done all the complicated work, he said, "You're crazy. I'll edit the film," in exchange for lunch money every afternoon. Working on the edit, he remarked on how she'd borrowed elements from both Visconti and Orson Welles. She informed him she had never seen either of their films, so he suggested films to check out at the Cinematheque. She kept returning to that cinema to watch more and more films, and eventually said, she says, quote, "I got the disease." The film premiered at Cannes, but the screening was funded by her mom. It played with Jean Vigo's documentary film Apropos de Nice, from 1930, which we've talked about on this podcast before. The film sat for a long time before being picked up for a 2-week run by Le Studio Parnassus, the central hangout for Parisian cinephiles with its mix of eclectic programming. Varda watched one evening anxiously from the projection booth as people like Marguerite Duras, Chris Marker, and Francois Truffaut himself came in to watch her movie. After its screening, the reaction was mixed. Truffaut stated it was fake and seemed puzzled, while Marker defended it, making an observation about the connection of its two lead characters to metal and wood. LaPointe Court never made back its money, and Varda would not direct another film for 7 years, with Cleo from 9 to 7.
Wait, so Truffaut thought this movie was fake and then, like, ripped off its aesthetic later on?
I mean, it seems like a Truffaut move, so I'm not, it's not incredibly shocking.
Nice.
Yeah.
I guess not.
So, yeah, let's jump in. I guess first, since we're kind of starting the series, I mean, what is everybody's familiarity with the works of Agnes Varda? Michael, what about you?
I have seen several of her movies, but I feel like she has so many movies I can't say that I'm like very well versed. Like, I've seen a few movies from like her like 60s. Like, I'd seen this movie before, and I'd seen Cleo. I've seen a handful of other ones, and I saw Faces Places when that came out. But I feel like that there are some major, I've not seen enough of her movies to really feel like I have a good grasp on like what her career trajectory looks like. So,
yeah. What was your initial reaction to this one?
I liked it. It was about the same as when I watched it this time, a lot of it is looking at when it was released and being kind of surprised that the movie feels like it was released 10 years later, as far as like the way it kind of anticipates a lot of the style of like the, like post-neorealism, like European New Wave, you know? So like a lot of like French New Wave movies really feel like heavily indebted to this movie, or even like Bergman. Like, there's like those two shots that are basically the Persona shot in this movie. And so like,
yeah, I was thinking about him a lot in this one, because it just kind of has like those lingering shots that you see in, like we talked about a couple weeks back, in The Seventh Seal.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of this movie that feels, I like it, and I'm kind of appreciating it from like a historical perspective. But also, like, I don't know if this is like a real genre of movie, but there is definitely a genre of movie in which like people, like a couple, walk around and talk about their relationship. So like, you know, before movies, and then like you have like Certified Copy, which I feel like is very heavily indebted to this movie in certain ways. And like, there's like other movies like that too, where like people are just basically walking around a city, talking about their relationship. And like, I always dig those movies. And so that's like a lot of this movie is that. And I really like that element of it too, being an early example of that subgenre. But I mean, I like it. I think it's interesting, and good. There are, of the Varda movies I've seen, it's maybe not my absolute favorite, but I still like it.
Yeah. Miranda, how familiar are you with Agnes Varda?
You know, I've seen, you know, a decent number of her films. I guess, you know, her more well-known films like Cleo from 5 to 7 and Le Bonheur. I really also like The Gleaners and I. But this is a rewatch for me, and I think, you know, I've seen, it's been over a span of like maybe 5 or 6 years that I've watched her films, but this one I remember watching and being really taken with the photography and realize it, like the cinematography and whatnot of the film, and I was like, oh, I can definitely tell like her background's in photography. So this time around though, I really appreciated the whole section of the film where it's on the residence of La Pointe Court, and especially like the beginning, just how much there's movement within the you know, within the frame of like, you know, the shirts blowing in the breeze and just like the sounds of the water and even the water moving. I found it really relaxing. And I also enjoy films where it's like a, you know, a couple talking, you know, walking around the city and talking about the relationship. But I think for me, the whole town aspect kind of relaxed their relationship portion. But more so their conversation seemed too, not artificial, but like almost trying to be highbrow, but like it's almost a little bit, gets to be a tad bit too pretentious for me. But I don't know. Sometimes I like Varda, but sometimes there are some lines where I'm like, it kind of falls flat for me. I don't know if I'm just getting too cynical. I don't know. But overall, I enjoyed this, and I thought it was, like, a really good feature. I was like, especially the staging. I was like, man, if that's your first film, like, good for you. Like, so, yeah.
Yeah, and she really, I mean, she didn't have any formal training, and she also, I mean, like, she admitted when Elaine Renee was talking about Orson Welles and Visconti, that she really hadn't seen many movies, so she really didn't have like a reference point of like, this is what I'm trying to do. She just kind of was making what she thought looked nice.
And it was good. It was very nice.
It is like such an interesting, like unconventional vision to have like basically half of the movie be like neorealism basically, or even like documentary-esque, you know, like there's those like, just those shots of like, they're like dipping their nets in tar or whatever that is. You know, and just the kind of like, just minutia of like what this town's like day-to-day life is comprised of. And then you like juxtapose that with something that feels very like modernist and almost like at the time, like not futuristic, but like cutting edge with like the dialogue is kind of pretentious, but it like feels like very much of like the highbrow mid-century, like European stuff. And that's like such an interesting thing where, you know, I'm trying to document working class life while having these like Parisian, well, I guess one of them's Parisian, like people talk like Parisians as they walk through. And like, I don't know how much commentary there's meant to be on like the contrast between those two, but it is like an interesting contrast, the like almost academic, like philosophizing of the central couple compared to the really like hands-on, like tactile lives of the rest of the residents.
Yeah, did you like the kind of way it would float back and forth between the kind of quote narrative of the movie and then the kind of documentary, almost the documentary narrative of the people in the town? Because it took me a little while to kind of figure out what was going on, because you start very much like you have that kind of very entertaining opening sequence with the fishermen and there's like the guy like walking around the house and they're like, I think it's an inspector. and you like have that whole sequence, and then, you know, it kind of muddles around for a while, and then it picks up with the married couple. But I don't know, yeah, like you said, Michael, it's kind of a weird juxtaposition between this somewhat academic intellectual kind of marriage discussion and then just these working class people just kind of living their life and for the most part like trying to just survive. But I mean, the way that she's able to kind of cut back and forth is, I don't know. I agree. It's kind of fascinating, especially as like a first film. But what did you all think about the way that she balances those two narratives?
I think at times it's disorienting because, like, I remember the first time watching it, I kept kind of scrutinizing the like non-marriage scenes for connections to the marriage scene, because I was anticipating there to be some sort of connection. So like there's a marriage that's being discussed, or like a prospective marriage that's being discussed in the town that has like no real connection to like the central couple. But I remember watching it the first time and really thinking, like, being confused at times, thinking like, oh, they're talking about the couple, or maybe this is a flashback of some kind or something. And in the end, it's not. It's just these two things simultaneously exist within the world. And I felt less disoriented this time around, just because I had seen it before. But I still had that feeling where I couldn't remember when a scene starts. Like, there's not always an indication of like what mode the movie's going to be in, and it's kind of weird, in like a, I think, an interesting way, to be that the movie like makes me like puts me off guard like that.
Yeah, I think the first time I watched it, I don't remember being necessarily like confused or taken, you know, back or by it or anything. But this time around, I just kind of, I don't know. I realized that they were both, you know, happening at the same time, but I just kind of let it, you know, come to me. But I will say there were some times that, you know, like a scene ends with the couple and it's pretty abrupt and jumps into, you know, the, you know, the life of the residents in the town. So that did take me off guard, but once I settled into that, I was fine. But I have a question, like, so talking about how trying to like make these two, or like how maybe residence life complements like the relationship, I felt like there was one point where they kind of matched up. I don't know if we can talk about that. Like, I think they're talking about like the end of, you know, she's talking about how she thinks their relationship needs to end or something. And, or no, maybe this is just, I think it happens around the same time. Like, there's that, and that kid is sick. And then from what I gathered, somebody drowns a kitten or a cat, and then the boy dies. And that was the only moment where things seemed to, that was weird.
Yeah, there are those kind of interesting, like, the movie kind of, like, echoes itself, which is, I don't exactly know what to say about it, but it's like kind of compelling when it matches up, and it feels almost surreal in the way that like a movie where otherwise like these threads are kind of existing parallel to one another but not really intersecting, you all of a sudden like see these kind of like overlapping themes at least. And like, I mean, that kind of feels like to me part of the project of the movie, which is to like throw disconnected, like things that are disconnected in like obvious ways, but that like, you know, are all happening around each other, and to see at what points do those things like bounce off of each other. Like, I'd be interested to know like how planned out, like, you know, the sequences of scenes would be, you know, or, you know, did they have like all the different threads in their head, like, and kind of set them up against each other to see what would happen? Or like, I don't know. This part of this movie just feels so like incidental and like almost off the cuff. And then other parts feel so planned, and it's like a really striking, like weirdly like experimental way to render like two like kind of conventional modes, like kind of conventional neorealism, kind of conventional like romantic dialogue. But then like when you have them like running next to one another, they all of a sudden become weird because they like have these strange kind of things. It's kind of like in the documentary about the like Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, where all the people like, you know, are talking about their conspiracy theories, and one of the conspiracy theories is like, if you play The Shining backwards and overlay it over The Shining playing forwards, the images will match up at certain points. And like the parts where there's like those like kind of echoes of each other kind of feel like that, maybe, where it's like, it feels like a cosmic accident that like these things all line up, which is like cool. cool. And I don't really know what else to say about that. But
well, it's kind of interesting, and I'm sure like we'll be more informed on it a little bit by watching some of kind of her late period stuff. But it seems like in her late period, she is like, this is, I think you had mentioned it in your Letterboxd review, Michael, but she kind of is interested in like merging the kind of basic narrative with this kind of faux or sometimes real like documentary footage, and kind of likes the pair to the two. And she kind of has that going on in something like Faces Places, where you have like this kind of the narrative itself is almost fake, where it's like this whole thing where she's kind of journeying across the country and she's gonna go see Godard and all that stuff. And then, but then you also have like her and JR in different places where they're meeting real people and like engaging with them, and that's like more documentary focused. And so I think it'll be interesting to kind of think back on this first film after we kind of watch through her movies, but then also kind of her late period movies, where it seems like she's like engaging with that like marriage between documentary and just fiction narrative, but in a much more, like, she's much more experienced and understanding of like how she's going to control the format.
One of the interesting things I remember thinking about when I saw Faces Places was that it kind of has like an HGTV show feel, in the sense of like kind of the blending of like obviously scripted scenes that are meant to like augment the actual documentary scenes in a way that's kind of seamless. And this movie in some ways feels like you've pulled apart the script, obviously scripted scenes, from the more documentary scenes in a way where they don't quite match up as seamlessly. In a way that like when a printer, the color is misaligned, so you can more clearly see like where the colors are separated from one another. And like, I don't know, like there is something about like in a documentary, there's an artificiality to like every element of documentary, even the most like verite documentary. There is an artificial nature to at least like how you edit the film and put it together. And it feels like, I mean, maybe this is something that is more played out in like, you know, her later films, but like there is something to be said about like putting something that feels as like movie-like as the central couple, you know, and considered and like fussy as like the dialogue that the central couple has, and like putting that with stuff that feels more lived in and like quote unquote realistic, that like calls attention to like the kind of artifice of like any sort of attempt to make something realistic, which is that like there are always going to be pieces that are constructed in some way. And this movie kind of like really highlights and underlines like the more obviously constructed parts, with like the dialogue of the couple, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Because I think especially late in her career, from the ones that I've seen, she kind of has this obsession with like the artificiality of what movies are, but then how they heighten like the artificiality of life. And it seems like that's already kind of planted in her mind through this one, because I mean, like we've described, you have those moments where it feels like the fiction and the nonfiction are kind of overlapping in a way. And it seems like that's kind of something that overall, again, these are like the limited amount that I've seen, but especially in some in kind of her later work and her documentaries, like the way that like the artificiality of you know, the movie, the fiction, and the nonfiction, just real life, like are able to overlap, and how that just kind of fascinates her. Like it, I mean, sometimes she definitely tries to make like an overall point, but I think a lot of the times it's just like, isn't this weird? Like, this is cool. And it seems like it's kind of like planted in this first movie, just in terms of, and so that's why it works to a degree, but at the same time, it also feels like there's a little bit of this, it's not necessarily aligning all that much.
I have like two thoughts on that. One is kind of like a meta larger thought on like the Cinematary series, but it's interesting that like our next director series is Abbas Kiarostami, who is like basically has the same preoccupations with like the dissonance between documentary and fiction and the ways that those match up. It'll be interesting to see like in the context of having like gone through Varda, like how that guy's films match up or have different ideas about that. But the second thing is about like this film's place in the French New Wave, which I think the French New Wave isn't that dissimilar from what you're describing Varda in that it's like interested in artificiality. But the French New Wave was more interested in like how movies in general are artificial. So like in this movie, in La Pointe Court, you get kind of like they make the dialogue, the romantic dialogue kind of like really stilted and like philosophical as a way, like by the end, the characters kind of agree that like our relationship is something that's artificial, but there is something like meaningful about the artificiality of it. And I kind of feel like that, like a lot of the French New Wave is doing that too, like especially like Godard or something like that, like Breathless, like is taking like, you know, Hollywood genre tropes, but kind of ratcheting up the artificial feel of them and kind of pointing out like, you know, the weird like stiltedness of like the tropes of that. And like I feel like a lot of like French New Wave is doing that, is where there's a sort of like heightened awareness of like we're doing something fake, but there's something meaningful in doing something fake. And you know, the fact that like this movie like predates that so much is just like really interesting, that it has like those stylistic and philosophical connections to like the movement as a whole.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely something I did want to talk a little bit about, because we mentioned it, I think, at the top, but you know, when you think of the French New Wave, a lot of people go to like Breathless and the 400 Blows and, you know, movies of that nature. But as you said, I think both of you said at the beginning, like you feel instances of kind of that style and what that movement was like in this movie, which I think is 5 years ahead of, at least I think maybe 400 Blows, I think I saw. It was like 5 years ahead of that. And so I don't know, watching this and thinking about your familiarity with that period of film history. I mean, where do you put like La Pointe Court up against some of those famous French New Wave films?
I mean, I like some of those more famous ones better than this. Like, I would rather watch The 400 Blows than La Pointe Court, even though I like this movie. Just because La Pointe Court feels like an experiment, like not experimental film, but it feels like an experiment in like something, whereas The 400 Blows feels less experimental and more like an embodied experience of a film. But like I said at the top, like I like have a ton of appreciation for like the historical precedence of this. And I mean, I like Cleo from 5 to 7 a lot better than this movie too, which I think is like, you know, 100% like a French New Wave film. And it's interesting to see like in this movie, just the kind of like primordial impulses of the French New Wave. And so like in some ways that the fact that I like those other French New Wave movies better makes this movie more interesting, because I can kind of pick out the pieces of those other French films and see them kind of mirrored in this film in a slightly rougher around the edges way. I don't know. I don't feel like I actually said anything about it except that I like it.
Yeah. Miranda, what about you?
No, I actually agree. I enjoyed it. I mean, this is something I would definitely have to be in the mood for, but I agree. I think it's because it does seem so much like an experiment. And I mean, at least with like the 400 Blows, like on its basic level, like just the narrative itself is a little more engaging. Yeah, and I'm actually, now that you mentioned, like, Cleo from 5 to 7, too, I mean, that film, she also takes, like, this idea of artificiality to, like, brings that into Cleo from 5 to 7. So I think even in that case, like, if that's kind of where I wanted to go, I would move to Cleo from 5 to 7. But I agree, I think it's more, it's interesting to see that this was, you know, 5 years before 400 Blows, and seeing, you know, kind of, like, what would be you know, what would come in the new wave era, but Michael said that much more eloquently than I did. So everything. So
I mean, I think it's also telling, like, as far as like how the history of the French New Wave is taught. Like, I remember, you know, you read film history, and like in the movement, there's always like the like A tier like artists who are associated with something. And that's like, it's always Godard and Truffaut, right? Those are the guys that you see the French New Wave as. And Varda, if it's mentioned, if she's mentioned, is like, you know, oh, and there was also Agnès Varda and like, you know, whatever. But I think it's like, you know, really telling that like all, you know, you said in your keynote, whatever intro, Zach, like, I mean, all those guys saw this movie. And it was clearly like influential, like demonstrably influential on like the style of those movies, but it's not as widely taught as something like Breathless or 400 Blows, which are like capital C canonical movies. Whereas this is sort of like an oddity, I think, in history, in film history.
I think there's no like necessarily evidence to back it up, but I feel like that's a little bit because of the kind of the male gaziness, just of, you know, film scholarship. I mean, you think of like, especially like with the characters. I mean, 400 Blows just kind of has like this canonical label on it, and then Breathless does as well. But Breathless also has like, you know, this kind of sexiness, this romance to these two lead, to its two lead characters, and so there's nothing really sexy about La Pointe Court, you know. it's very matter of fact. And so there's none of that kind of, even something like her husband, Jacques Demy, like Lola, his first movie, you know, there's a sexiness to it. There's a romance to it. And this one, because it's just sitting there like investigating the romance, it's not as, you know, I don't think we were to the before trilogy part of wanting to watch movies yet, because it clearly just didn't hit.
Well, and the leads both have really bad haircuts, and I think that's probably a factor as well. Is there's just such a lack of pretense of making these people like movie-like, which is like really kind of interesting. But I'm like just looking at the poster here on Letterboxd now, and that dude, like, legit looks like he has like
a terrible haircut.
It's like a bowl cut, like the classic, like you put the bowl on your head and then you like just really quickly whip those scissors around, and just like, you know, more power to him.
I'm gonna be honest, and this might be mean, but looking at the Letterboxd poster, it kind of looks like it looks like Shrek and Fiona when they become humans. I'm sorry. Just saying.
Miranda, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, I don't know. I just don't think they're like very attractive. I mean, I'm sure they're really nice people.
They have a great personality.
They have wonderful personalities. They have a weird pet donkey. It's weird.
On the, like, back to the question of like her place in like the French New Wave, like, I know, like, one of the big, like, narratives of the French New Wave is the idea that these film critics became filmmakers themselves. And, like, was Varda involved in, like, Cahiers du Cinéma or any of that sort of stuff? Like, or is she kind of, like, an outsider in that? And maybe that has to do with, like, her place in the canon as well.
That's actually a really good point, because Zach, you said at the beginning introducing the film that Varda reached out to André Bazin about
Alain René.
She reached out to Alain René, or about him. Yes. So that, I mean, I know her background's in photography, so that actually is a good point. Yeah, she doesn't have that film background, because like Truffaut and Godard, they were all obsessed with, like, you know, Ford and, you know, Hawks, like that movies were their thing. I mean, among like other, you know, literature and whatnot, but especially film. So that's actually a good point. And I would buy that. That might be part of it, because it doesn't fit that narrative.
Yeah. I would have to do a little bit more research, but I don't think she was like really, she is now, like, looking back at it now, she's included kind of in that, but like when it was actually happening, I think she was very much on the outside. just because she didn't
have... Well, and also, yeah. When did Cleo come out? Because, like, the break... Or not Cleo. Was Cleo her next movie?
Yeah, so 7 years after 1955.
So, like, that gap is also, like, when all that starts as well. So, like, for whatever reason why she wasn't, you know, working as a, like, a feature film director, she kind of... missed like the big or initial push that like those like other directors had at the beginning of the 60s, I guess.
And, you know, sexism.
Yeah, I feel like that's got to factor in somewhere. There's like at the end of Faces Places, there's the scene where she goes to see Godard and he just like shows like stands her up, and like that kind of feels like I mean, I like Godard's movies for the most part and stuff, but like that kind of feels like characteristic of like the whole scene, at least as far as like how its legacy, which is that like, you know, Godard is like doing his thing and Varda is like around, like, but they're not like in the same place at the same time, and probably because Godard was being kind of an ass, maybe that's like, yeah.
Any final thoughts on La Pointe Court before we wrap up?
I don't.
It's good. I don't know if it's a good starting place for Varda. It wasn't mine, but if you are at all interested in like the things that we talked about, like it's like an interesting piece of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree. I wouldn't start here. I would start with like Cleo from 5 to 7 or something like that. Yeah, I'm excited to kind of... It seems like this is a little... I mean, it's the first movie, so it kind of seems natural, but it seems like this is somewhat of a Rosetta Stone for a lot of her movies, and kind of what... It seems like kind of laid the groundwork for how she's... what she's thinking about in a lot of movies. So, yeah, check it out. Well, there's... you know, we did not plan this, but, you know, Criterion just dumped a bunch of her movies, including I think all of the ones that we're talking about in this series on Criterion Channel. So there you go. We're, you know, the series brought to you by Criterion Channel. We're gonna force a sponsorship.
Yeah, Criterion, sponsor us.
Yeah, exactly. Come on, guys. All right, well, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we put all the movies that we talked about in this episode. Head over to our Patreon, patreon.com/cinematary. We failed this past month on doing a Film Theory and Chill, but I promise we'll get one for this month. We did have our first watch party, so hopefully we'll have another one this next month for our patrons, but... Thank you so much to our patrons, Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Cindy Roberts, Harry Eskin, Hell Yeah Small World, Joe Jordan, Maggie, Matthew Lingo, Pedro Seraphim, Ron Hayes, The Kittiest of Kittens, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, Whitney Real Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, we will start our first of two double features of Varda films. Next week, we will be doing Le Bonheur from 1965 and One Sings, the Other Doesn't from 1977. Again, if you want to check out the full series list, we got it at cinematary.com. Head over there. We got a new review of Bill and Ted Face the Music from Logan Kinney. I went through the Trip series and reviewed the most recent one, The Trip to Greece, and then we have a review of Tesla. So, three 2020 releases, even though, you know, the theaters aren't really kicking stuff out. We got those, and I don't know. Don't go see Tenet in theaters. That's all I recommend. Just don't go to the movie theater. I don't want you to do that. And thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.